Here's the latest from Canadian lawyer, Law Times, and Lexpert on April 14th, 2023. I'm Steve Randall. Canadian lawyers been finding out how law firms have implemented a four-day work week without losing productivity. Canada is leading in a four-day work week among the global legal sector, according to work time reduction expert Joe O'Connor. For law firms and other professional services which bill by the hour, a four-day work week without a productivity dip can be achieved through one of a combination of two strategies, he says. The first is reducing a sufficient level of non-billable overhead to sustain client work at the same levels. The second method, O'Connor sees, is companies changing their billing structure, moving to value-based or project-based billing, allowing them to decouple the direct relationship between hours and revenue. O'Connor is director and co-founder at the Work Time Reduction Center of Excellence.
When we talk about the shorter work week, it's not just about changing the number of hours that people work, but it's about fundamentally changing the way that people work.
The Ontario Court of Appeal has ordered a new trial in a sexual assault case where the trial counsel of a black accused refused to challenge potential jurors for racial bias because he did not want to accuse them of racism. Chris Rudnicki and Teresa Doncor were counsel for the appellant, who argued he had experienced ineffective assistance of counsel at his trial. They are criminal defense lawyers at Rudnicki & Company in Toronto. Rudnicki spoke about the appeal.
The appeal was about when effective assistance of counsel amounts to a miscarriage of justice. That's the test that we have to satisfy in order to justify a new trial in a case where it's alleged that trial counsel was incompetent. So mere incompetence on its own is not enough. You have to show that it went further and amounted to a miscarriage of justice, which is what the court agreed with.
Doncor addressed the importance of the process they used.
The challenge for cause process is, I think, the only tool that the accused themselves have to screen jurors for racial bias. So I think it's extremely important. I think it's great that the court is acknowledging the importance of it.
Canadian lawyer spoke with Eugene Meehan of Supreme Advocacy about the Supreme Court of Canada and how appellate litigation has changed. He spoke about how post-pandemic interveners are now encouraged to appear virtually, even as the main parties have returned to in-person proceedings.
Interveners are invited, sometimes more than invited, to appear remotely. Parties have the option to choose. That is a difference. The court is more used to a virtual appearance. And that may be there for the long term. It may not be there for the long term. In terms of interveners, it is significant because there have been some recent cases where there have been as many as 29 interveners. So from the intervener's perspective, it may not be as helpful because most lawyers like to be in court for the eye contact presence. And even in the Supreme Court of Canada, when one is arguing in the Supreme Court of Canada, even with nine judges, the design of the dais and where the lawyer is arguing from, there's actually eye contact with all nine judges. So it may not be as good for the interveners or the lawyers themselves, but the court certainly seems to like at least the interveners being virtual.
Mental health issues in the workplace are becoming more recognised, but Labour and employment lawyer Madeleine Loewenberg says the need for objective evidence is also growing to determine how much the workplace environment is impacting an employee's mental health. Loewenberg is a speaker at Canadian Lawyers' Labour and Employment Masterclass on April 25th.
Stats are that in any given week, 500,000 Canadians don't go to work because of a mental health problem or illness. And that it is in fact the number one cause or number one complaint around disability in Canada, and that's 30% of disability claims and 70% of disability claim costs. So obviously it's an area that it has grown and continues to grow in importance.
A federal private members bill prioritising defined pension plan members during a company's insolvency is making its way through Parliament. However, restructuring and pension lawyers at Blake Castles and Graydon LLP say unintended consequences could lead to a dramatic decrease in defined benefit plans, considered by many the gold standard for funding retirement. Kelly Bourassa explains where the bill is at and what it will do when it becomes law.
The Senate committee reviewed it earlier this year, and at present it's at third reading. And what the bill does is it expands the scope of pension protections in an insolvency or bankruptcy of an employer.
Blake's partner, Jeff Summers, says that some suggestions are being made that wouldn't prompt employers and lenders to get rid of defined benefit plans, given that they're seen as being better than other options for retirees.
So one of the suggestions made was, well, could we allow, you know, the government or the pension regulators to appoint an administrator to come in and basically keep running the plan and let it wind down slowly over time and therefore hopefully lessen the negative impact on people.
A Law Society Tribunal disciplinary panel says that Toronto personal injury lawyer Jeremy Diamond must not practice law for 3 months and has been fined $100,000 after being found guilty of professional misconduct for misleading advertising. But it's not an outright suspension, according to the order issued last week, says his client intends to appeal the ruling. Still, Diamond must comply, as if suspended, with Sections 2 and 4 of the Law Society's guidelines for lawyers who are suspended or who have given an undertaking not to practice. The $100,000 fine imposed on Diamond is the maximum permitted, the panel said, adding that it decided not to only fine Diamond, as it concluded a fine would be seen just as a mere cost of doing business, which would not significantly serve the penalty goals of specific deterrence, general deterrence, and maintaining public confidence. Diamond is the face of Diamond & Diamond, known for billboards, bus ads and TV and radio spots with slogans such as, "Nothing is tougher than a diamond." Yet Diamond earlier admitted to engaging in professional misconduct in marketing the firm, with the tribunal decision saying it was false and deceptive to market legal services that the lawyer did not in fact provide and to market himself as an expert personal injury lawyer. In 2021, Diamond admitted before the panel that between 2013 and 2017, he improperly marketed personal injury legal services by failing to disclose clearly and prominently that Diamond & Diamond referred thousands of potential clients to other lawyers for fees. He later sought to revoke that admission after the tribunal. However, the panel determined last August that he should not be permitted to withdraw his admissions of professional misconduct and would decide the appropriate penalty. Paul Eric Veal, a lawyer at Lensner Slatt, spoke with Canadian Lawyer about what initially prompted him to begin creating a database of court and tribunal decisions with what his firm now calls its data-driven decisions program.
I can pinpoint for you the moment in my litigation work that sort of started me on this path that I'm now on of trying to incorporate quantitative or empirical legal analysis. So I was either a third or a fourth year lawyer, in any event, a relatively junior associate, and I was preparing for what was going to be my first jury trial. I was acting in that case for a physician. He was a defendant in a medical negligence claim. And I was meeting with him a few weeks in advance of trial, and one of the things I said to him was, well, look, you know, this is a jury trial. The jury really wants to see that you're involved and engaged. And so, you know, for the 2 weeks of the trial, it would be good if you could come to court every day to show them that you care about the case. You're not strictly required to, but it would be good if you were there. And he said to me, okay, well, fair enough. I'm happy to do that. But, you know, it's complicated because I've got patients booked for things, and the only way I can make a living and support my family is by going to the office, and I don't get paid a salary if I don't see patients. And so if you're telling me I should close my clinic, I'm perfectly happy to do that. But you know, I just want to make sure that that's actually associated with an increased likelihood of success at trial. I assume there are studies that show that when defendants show up to jury trials, they're more likely to win. To which I sort of had to respond, well, no, actually, we don't study these things. The practice of law doesn't work that way. It's a bunch of old lawyers who've been doing something for 30 or 40 years say this is the way we should do things, and then the newer generation just learns that collective knowledge really without interrogating it in any kind of systematic way. And that's true. I mean, lawyers are storytellers, and we tend to learn things and do things by way of narratives that make sense, but not necessarily interrogating those narratives with anything other than argument, right? We don't really historically anyways interrogate those narratives with data. And so that was an unsatisfying answer for him, but also an unsatisfying answer for me. It seemed like we should be able to do better than that in answering questions. And it was sort of that moment coupled with sort of my background in economics, or my undergrad, my master's, sort of thinking about how the social sciences try and explore these issues that got me thinking, gee, I wonder if we actually can collect data and do better.
The Supreme Court of Canada is hearing a case addressing the cabinet records exemption in Ontario's Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act, FIPPA, next week. Justin Safayeni is a partner at Stockwoods and counsel for the CBC, which sought 23 mandate letters Ontario Premier Doug Ford sent to cabinet ministers following the 2018 election. The Premier denied access, arguing the letters were protected by the cabinet records exemption under Section 12.1 of FIPPA.
The nub of the case is the interpretation of what's called the cabinet records exemption in FIPPA, which is our Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act here in Ontario.
The Ontario government's decision to stop provincial funding for virtual care by emergency room physicians at the end of March, along with an earlier move to reduce OHIP payments for family doctors who provide virtual care, not only eliminates innovative pathways to healthcare, but is something that could violate provincial and federal legislation, says health law practitioner Brooke Schechter. However, Schechter says that it's unlikely that family physicians will challenge the move.
What it will mean, I don't think that you're going to find any physicians, family physicians challenging that move. They'll just stop being able, they just won't be able to provide virtual care.
You'll find the links to these stories in the show notes. And to get the latest CL Talk episodes automatically in your favorite podcast app, just click follow or subscribe.